You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong toki ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā, rapere te re, te rā te kaumārua o Mahuru. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 12th of September. I'm Justin, and if you're wondering, Stuart's away for this week, and I'm with you for the next hour. But as a sign of normality, Deb Rawson is joining me in the studio next to me. How are you today?
I'm good. How's it going? We can pretty much do whatever now that Stuart's away, right?
Yes, and we have both, taken apart Stuart's normal structure for programming, and we have put in our own flavour, Justin and Debs.
I hope he's not listening right now.
I hope not, because I probably won't get another wire if he hears about it. FIR Kene, coming up on the show today, I talked to Justice Minister Andrew Little about mental health, abortion law, and National Leader Simon Bridges' recent trip to China. Education Minister Chris Hipkins talked to Deb on changes to the way New Zealand history is taught in schools. International Desk is giving an update on Hong Kong, as I talked to two Hong Kong high school students who organised class boycotts. And finally, on Neighbourhood Watch, we go across the Tasman Sea to Australia, as our correspondent in Adelaide, Zoe, talks about federal welfare reform and a protest against a highway in Victoria. E aha o whakaro, let us know your thoughts throughout the show. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can do so by texting us on 5395, why am I call us in studio on 309-3879 or tweet us at 95BFM News. Me kua e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene korero ano he pakahere roki roki marunga I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho me haere ki 95BFM iratakati.com. And don't forget, you can catch all these stories in full and more by podcast on our website 95BFM.com. I tēnei wā tonu, and now?
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labour MP Andrew Little.
Yes, and after being away last week, our Justice Minister Andrew Little joined me this morning, and we discussed quite a lot of recent government announcements, and we started by making New Zealand history a compulsory subject at schools.
Look, this is long overdue, and I know in my role as Minister of Treaty Negotiations, I get to see what we call the historical accounts. Every treaty settlement with an iwi as part of it, there's this agreed historical account. It's a piece of scholarship worked on by both iwi representatives or iwi historians and Crown historians. And it tells the story of that particular iwi and what happened down the ages. To them, in some cases it deals with the wars that were carried out and the colonial troops attacking Marae and what have you. So I've started to build up a picture of events that I know and not many New Zealanders know about. And so the more opportunity we get to tell the story of New Zealand and acknowledge it, then it means that as a country we can face the future with a greater degree of confidence, because it's based on a shared understanding of our history.
Another big government announcement for the past week has to be on mental health. So this isn't part of your portfolio, but are you confident that these new initiatives can bring down New Zealand's suicide rates?
Yeah, I can. What we've specifically announced this week is a suicide prevention strategy, and having a dedicated resource within the Ministry of Health, the Office of Suicide Prevention, to lead that strategy and to monitor initiatives that are being taken and to monitor what they are achieving. We know that suicide is we have a very high incidence of suicide, and when you look at where it's striking most, it's young men, it's older men, it's Māori and Pacifica. So we need we need to be putting a real focus on this in a way that we haven't before. We know that our mental health and sort of depression treatment services have been run down over many years, and this government made a commitment that we would put that right. We made a significant investment in this year's budget to do that over the next 4 years with more services, more treatment centres, dealing with addiction, putting more money into that. And part of that is also then dealing with those whose situation and mental health is such that you know, they contemplate suicide. So the more we can do to educate about that, understand it, and support anybody and whānau, family and whānau of people going through through that sort of depression, then the better we will do and the better chance we have of reducing our dreadful suicide statistics.
And because we were on youth suicide rates, I see these new initiatives seemed to be only on the national level and with district health boards. And because youth suicide rates are going up, why aren't these new measures targeting schools?
Oh, no, they will. And there is, part of the suicide prevention plan involves what we do at the school level. So we've already started an initiative, actually, that started in Canterbury following the earthquakes, of putting professional help within schools. And, you know, it's through social workers, trained counsellors, and making services and treatment much easier to access. We know that for a lot of people, their first port of call is their GP, and making it easier to go from your GP, first of all, supporting GPs to understand symptoms, and then making it easier for GPs to refer people to counselling. And a lot of it is talk therapy. It's not about medicines and pharmaceuticals and drugs. It is about giving people the chance just to talk through what it is, the challenges that they're going through. So all of that is in the plan. That's what the Suicide Prevention Office will be monitoring. But what, you know, making it easier for young people to get access to support and help, starting with the schools, is absolutely a vital part of that.
Speaking of GP visits, the National Party has said some of these initiatives are nothing new because they only covered the cost of existing mental health provision and GPs and PHOs. What's your response to that?
Well, they've just got it completely wrong. We know one of the reasons why we've made the significant investment, and it had to be a significant investment in mental health and addiction services, is that the workforce has been run down. The number of counsellors and other professionals who are available to do the work, we just don't have enough. So one of the priority initiatives is building the workforce that is needed to meet, you know, to meet current needs, and that's more counsellors, more psychologists, more psychiatrists. And look, some of them we can get from overseas, but actually, you know, when we're dealing particularly in Māori communities and Pacifica communities, we need people who are steeped in their worlds, who are able to provide counselling and support and help in a way that is culturally relevant to them. So building the workforce is a priority task. And look, it's easy for the National Party to say there's no new ideas. The reality is that none of these ideas have been backed and resourced in the past in the way that this government is doing.
Moving on to an ongoing issue in your portfolio, now your bill that decriminalises abortion is now in select committee stage in Parliament. So what's the current progress?
Look, as far as I know, it's making good progress. The deadline for submissions hasn't closed, but the committee, and it's a specialist select committee, is already hearing from people, and they heard from the Abortion Supervisory Committee. No, they heard from the Law Commission this week, and the Law Commission was the one that prepared the report for me last year on how to shift abortion from the criminal framework that it sits in at the moment to a health framework. And they pretty much laid out to the committee what they set out in the report and said sort of where the challenges were. So there was nothing particularly new there. But it is the basis on which the current proposed law is being debated. It's very much based on what the Law Commission said in their report, but with a few amendments that means that, you know, we have got the level of support that we've got in the House. So look, what the Select Committee does is a very important part of the process. There'll be a lot of people who will want to have their say, and they'll have the chance to do that over the next few months. I'm not expecting the Select Committee to report back to Parliament until early next year. So I would say February, March next year, before the next major step by Parliament is taken.
Regardless of what the Select Committee reports back to Parliament. Are you still confident that you can get your coalition partner, New Zealand First, to support this bill?
Look, I don't take anything for granted, and although I think the first reading passed with a pretty good margin, there's no guarantee that that will continue. And in fact, I expect that number to reduce. But look, every party is represented on the Select Committee, and I think there's good dialogue between the parties. I continue to have good dialogue with the Green Party, with New Zealand First, and with the National Party about it. And I think the committee will do a good job. They do want to hear from New Zealanders, and I'm sure there will be changes to the bill, and those changes will be necessary to make it effective and to make it work. But at the moment, there's a good foundation for them to do that work and to have that debate. And in the end, it's a debate that every New Zealander needs to have.
Right. National leader Simon Bridges, he has recently went to China and met with a state councillor who's in charge of Chinese state security, as well as having an interview with Chinese state media, which he praised the Chinese Communist Party. So what is your reaction to this?
I certainly think the meeting with the chap who's politically responsible for their state security services was an unusual meeting to have.
Do you think it is appropriate?
Well, I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I did it when I was leader of the opposition. I did a visit to China. I met the vice president. I met a number of people, but I didn't. I wasn't offered, and I wouldn't have accepted an opportunity to meet the head of the security services. It's not the right thing for a senior politician from another country to do. So I thought that was unusual. Look, Chinese media are interested in New Zealand. He gave an interview to a Chinese TV station. And everybody speaks very carefully in those sorts of interviews. I think he did that. But he did seem very enthusiastic about the Chinese Communist Party. I think most people try to maintain at least the technical distinction between the Chinese Communist Party and the government, the People's Republic of Chinese government. But the language he used seems to salute the Communist Party, which at a political level is one thing. But in the end, we engage with the state, with the country, as opposed to the political parties within it.
Coming back closer to home, because you are the Minister of the SIS and GCSB, do you think China is now influencing New Zealand politics?
Look, I know that our agencies have expressed concern that there is a risk of that, and I think it's a risk that applies in many other countries too. And I think that is often expressed through political party donations, and often channeled through New Zealand registered companies. That's one of the real risks that they pointed out in their comments to the Select Committee recently. And that's something that I think I think all political parties in New Zealand want Parliament to deal with. I know the Select Committee has had some advice about that. I'm getting advice from officials about what we can do, what we need to do to tighten up our laws. Look, these things are a risk. Whether it's happening in fact, it's always difficult to detect, and I think the most important thing we can do is to make sure that our systems and procedures and our laws are as tight as possible to make sure that the risk of foreign interference and foreign influence is as low as possible.
You once said you need a banner phone for when you go to China. So does that mean New Zealanders' privacy are under threat if they are in China right now?
I'm not sure I said that. I was asked whether I had taken any precautions on my trip to China, and I said that I had followed advice to take a burner phone, which I did. And that is just, if you're a senior politician from any country, look, there is always a chance that you may be the target of those who want to listen to what you're saying and doing. That is just a reality.
Regardless, do you think it is time that we need to look into our policies on foreign interference?
I think we definitely need to be alert to the possibility of it happening, and I don't think the risks of foreign interference are confined to a single country. I think there are others, and I think there are other forms of influence that can be played out. But I think we do need to be alert to that, and that's why, having maximum transparency about you know, what politicians, especially ministers, you know, what is in our diaries, who we're meeting with. I think that is important, and that's why this government initiated the policy of proactive diary releases, so people do get to see who we're meeting with, who we're interacting with on a daily basis.
That was Labor MP Andrew Little.
The Wire.
Yes, and that was me talking to Justice Minister Andrew Little on making New Zealand history a compulsory subject in schools, new government mental health initiatives, abortion law, and Chinese-New Zealand relations. Ko te waia, tēnei marunga, irirangi poho. We will be back after a couple of messages.
Are you a dick?
Nah.
Do you like yummy food?
Oh, yeah.
Well then, what's for dinner tonight?
Well, I was thinking...
Wrong! What you need is a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make Lucky Tacos at home in just 10 minutes. Tasty, spicy, fresh, Lucky Tacos make you feel good. And with free delivery in Auckland, why not make it a ritual? Pick up a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit at your local Faro Fresh or get free delivery direct from the HQ at theluckytaco.co.nz.
What? What the hell?
Yeah, it's turned into a bit of a complicated install.
You've tipped out my undies drawer.
Yep.
My kimchi's gone everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a dog in the sink.
That's heat pumps, mate.
Don't leave it up to some cowboy. First Stop AC and Electrical are your first stop for heat pumps. The full range of models, top quality installations from an experienced team of installers. For a warmer, healthier home, First Stop AC and Electrical. Go to firststop.co.nz or call 0800 178 7867. That's 0800 178 7867.
What an occasion. My friends, the music, the atmosphere. You know what I could go for? An interesting cocktail.
Liquor King Delivery, everything you need for an interesting cocktail delivered to your door.
Hot dog!
Discover interesting cocktails and more at Liquor King. More than your average bottle store, Liquor King has that little something extra. And now there's free delivery on any order with code BFM. That's free delivery with code BFM. Liquor King. Go to lk.co.nz. Terms and conditions apply.
Ooh, what are your top 95 picks?
Excuse me, voting is confidential.
Ease up.
The secret ballot is an integral part of the democratic institution.
Come on, just... Hey, that's your band. Is it democratic to vote for yourself?
What? It's a crime to have self-esteem now? Well, lock me up, because I'm valid.
It's 95BFM's 50th anniversary, and we're counting down the 95 best BFM tunes of all time as chosen by you. Voting is open right now. Go have your say at 95bfm.com/top95 and vote for your top three all-time solid gold favourite BFM tunes. If you have a B card, you could be walking away with $950 cash. Massively mint! The NZ Vapor Top 95 Countdown. Vote now at 95bfm.com/top95. Thanks to nzvapor.com. Only a fire should smoke. In
the neighborhood. Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and following the trail of government announcements, what do you have for us, Deb?
This morning, the government announced plans to make the teaching of New Zealand history compulsory in schools. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says this will set a standardised national framework for learners to ensure they learn about the key aspects of our history, such as the arrival of Māori to Aotearoa New Zealand, the early colonial history, and Te Tiriti o Waitangi, among other things. I spoke with Education Minister Chris Hipkins, who started by explaining how New Zealand history is currently taught in the curriculum.
New Zealand history is effectively an optional subject in schools at the moment. It can be taught as part of the social studies strand of the New Zealand curriculum, but then so can other things like Tudor England history, for example. And what we've heard from New Zealanders over quite a period of time now is that actually New Zealanders do want their kids to be learning about New Zealand history, about the events that shaped us as a country. So that's what we're going to be changing. We're going to be adding a strand into the New Zealand curriculum as a core subject that is about New Zealand history.
Okay, so how will this change exactly? What topics will be covered?
The changes will mean that at every level of the New Zealand curriculum, New Zealand history will be woven into it. So kids from when they start school to when they finish school will have access to much more New Zealand history in their day-to-day learning. And that'll cover everything from the arrival of Māori to New Zealand, which happened over hundreds of years, through to the arrival of the first Europeans and the first encounters, through to colonisation and settlement, the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, the New Zealand Wars, through to the early 20th century history and the development of New Zealand's own unique national identity as we became to become a more independent country, stepping out from under the British Empire. So I think that there's this opportunity for us to be learning about all aspects of our history, the good, the bad, and the other.
So will all of these topics be compulsory to cover?
Well, the New Zealand history curriculum, or the insertion of the New Zealand history in the curriculum, will still be an enabling framework so that schools can teach things that are relevant to their students and that are relevant to them locally. So, for example, if you're in the Waikato, we would expect you to learn about the wars that happened there, the land wars that happened there. If you were in a school near Parihaka, you might go and visit Parihaka and learn about that. If you're up in the north, then you might learn about the significance of the treaty grounds and what happened there. Everywhere we go around the country, we're surrounded by our history, and we want to create the opportunity for schools to embed that local history in the way they're teaching.
And, I mean, you've already sort of answered this, but why is this important to New Zealanders?
I think every young New Zealander deserves the opportunity to learn about our country's history and our place in the world and how the events that have happened in our past shape our today and are going to continue to shape our tomorrow.
As this is so important, why is it only changing now? What has prompted this?
Look, this is something that I guess the parties in government, Labour and the Green Party, New Zealand First, we've been arguing about this for some time. So I think we're very pleased to be able to bring this to fruition. I think it's something New Zealanders have asked for some time.
And how will the curriculum change be designed?
So we'll be working on the curriculum changes in consultation with academics, with iwi around the country, with everyday New Zealanders, to ensure that the content that we want young people to learn about is prepared, is available, teachers are given the support that they need in order to have the confidence to teach it.
And this will be gradually introduced in 2022?
That's right. So full implementation around 2022, but a lot of work to go between now and then.
And what year levels will this affect? Is this purely for high school or...?
No, our decision is to weave New Zealand history into all levels of the curriculum. So, obviously it'll be pitched at an appropriate level. So when you're a very young student, you'll be learning about some basic kind of concepts around New Zealand history, and then you get into more detail as you work your way through the schooling system.
How will this interact with the Treaty of Waitangi?
Well, the Treaty of Waitangi is an important part of New Zealand's history, but it's important to understand the events that happened before the signing of the treaty, what happened after the signing of the treaty, and the significance of all of those. So, the treaty is our founding document as a nation, but actually there is an awful lot of events that happened before the treaty was signed that to really understand the essence of the treaty, you've got to understand those events. And then to understand the significance of it today, you also have to understand the things that happened after that.
Would you say that previously, well, as this wasn't part of the curriculum, would you see it as a lack of understanding of the importance of New Zealand history at a governmental level, or would you see it more as just that schools were left to decide what to teach and it ended out this way?
I think our schooling system's been on a bit of a journey itself, in that for quite some time we tried to write our history out of the teaching in schools. It wasn't that long ago, only a few generations ago, that young Māori were physically disciplined and punished if they spoke Te Reo Māori in school. And so, we've come a long way over that period of time. And I think that, now is the time for us to take the next step and make sure that all young New Zealanders are learning about all of our history.
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
That was Deb talking to Education Minister Chris Hipkins about making New Zealand history compulsory in schools. Remember, you can call us on 309 3879 or text us on 5395. Any thoughts you have. And now,
Today, we do not know what they want. They do not know themselves what they really want.
I've been wondering what that special place in hell looks like for those who promoted Brexit without even a sketch of a plan how to carry it.
Brexit means Brexit.
The Wire.
Good sting. What a great sting to make its debut. And yeah, on international desk, we are going to Hong Kong, where protests have now lasted for 3 months. It started as a protest against a controversial bill which amends the law to allow extradition from Hong Kong to mainland China, but now protests have evolved to demand more democratic rights and autonomy. The Hong Kong government has been criticised on how it handled the protests, as it refused to respond to protesters' demands, despite 2 million people, or one-third of Hong Kong's population, demonstrated in the streets. Police were also accused of power abuse, as they were seen overusing riot control weapons, conducting unnecessary stop and checks, mass arresting democracy activists and opposition lawmakers, as well as storming train stations in full riot gear, beating and pepper spraying civilians. I talked to Jason and Tiffany, which are not their real names, two Hong Kong high school students who organised class boycotts as part of the protests against the government.
The group at our school was originally organised by a handful of Year 12 students back in June when the protests against the extradition bill first started, because we didn't see a lot of discussion about the bill in school.
But now we have more than 20 members in the group after we launched an Instagram page, because we want to spread the message to other students and get more people involved in the discussion on what we are going to do next. The idea of that was to diversify our base and try to split up the workload.
I know you have organized class boycotts at your school last week. When did you decide to go on with this?
Well, we decided that in mid-August because we saw students from neighbouring schools who also decided to boycott classes at the first week of the new school year. That's why we followed suit, because we want to express our own opinions.
We felt that boycotting classes is a good idea, but only if our school and a couple of others did that. It won't be that effective in delivering the message. But when we saw a lot of other schools responding to the call for the boycott, we thought this would be effective and we decided to go along with it.
What did the school think of the boycott when you first brought the idea to them?
When we first talked to the school about a class boycott at the end of August, the school was against the idea, so we had to change the format of it from a class boycott to a public lecture.
And the school doesn't really want us to hold this event. And the reason we were allowed to hold this public lecture is because the school said they realised quite a lot of students were concerned about the issue. We also had other ideas to let our thoughts be heard, like handing out white ribbons and black masks or setting up an opinion wall. But the school didn't allow us to do that because they said the school was supposed to be politically neutral, and allowing that could cause fights between students with different viewpoints. We really weren't expecting that. But since the school year starts, there wasn't a lot of school-led discussion on recent protests, not even the Current Affairs School Club. I don't know what will happen later, but it seems to me that the school is using political neutrality as an excuse to ban any discussion on campus. If the school has an open and fair environment for any discussion, I have no doubt that students will be respectful. But what the school is now doing is the exact opposite, because they've already jumped to the conclusion that we'll be marginalising those with an opposing opinion, and this is not contributing to the situation at all.
What did the school think of the boycott when you first brought the idea to them?
I moved stuff to form barriers during the protest and stayed with other protesters until late at night. But who would expect this is the way that a high school student spends his summer holidays, protesting in the streets one second, then having a riot and tactical police running at you with their weapons out the next. This sort of pressure is one that I don't think anyone could understand unless they are really present there. And I will never forget one scene when a girl lost her eye because she was shot by a beanbag round from the police because I was close there when it happened. You never imagine these scenes before in your life, getting chased by police and seeing people getting shot.
One specific thing that I remembered was going to the rally with my friend in the CBD during a general strike in August. Suddenly, police fired tear gas into the crowd, and it felt like they were never going to stop. We don't have any protective gear like a gas mask, only a normal surgical one. We ran into the metro station and took the train two stops away. Because there's a lot of other protesters going in the same direction as well, we didn't take off our masks and change our clothes. There was a woman on the train next to us and she looked at us, frightened and stepped back. I was shocked because I don't understand why she did that. We didn't do anything illegal.
Do you feel that you have learned anything from the past 3 months, or maybe you have changed in some ways?
I think I did. Before the protest, I didn't pay a lot of attention to politics or any news in detail, but now my whole summer holiday was solely focused on the news. I read a lot on how legislation was changed in Hong Kong and how other protest methods work to see if I can contribute. But I think I now understand much more in detail what I am thinking on certain issues.
What about your peers? Do you think they have changed as well?
No, I think my friends and I got more similar towards each other. Maybe it's because we get similar information growing up. But I have some friends who disagree with me. Not that they disagree with protests in general, but on smaller details like jumping over ticket barriers when taking the train. We still talk to each other, but we tend to avoid being confrontational. But for myself, I think through these protests it changed my perspective of Hong Kong. Beforehand, I thought most people were selfish and calculating, but the past 3 months I only saw people helping and encouraging each other. Maybe it's the circumstances that we're in now, but people now are caring towards one another. And I also think my perspective on going to the front line of protests has also changed, because I used to feel guilty about not being there in person, but now I understand everyone has their own role in the protests, and mine is now running the school's concern group and organising demonstrations.
Chief Executive Carrie Lam has announced that she will officially retract the extradition amendment bill. Do you accept this outcome?
No. For the past 3 months, we have been demanding the government to fulfill the 5 demands the protesters listed. In fact, I don't think any Hong Kong citizens will accept that. 8 people have killed themselves because of the bill, more than 1,200 people have been arrested because of the subsequent protests, and some protesters have lost an eye. So we can't back down because the chief executive agreed only 1 out of the 5 demands.
Mm-hmm. 因為林鄭只不過係應承咗五個入邊其中一個訴求，而我哋會放棄。
我就一定會抽貨嘅。咁一樣啦，佢哋嗰個口號唔係真係淨係一個口號咯。點解我哋咁堅持要咁大數落去啊？分
號。I won't accept this outcome as well. The five demands from all Hong Kongers is just not a slogan, but the manifesto of these protests.All of us are backing these protests because we're angry at how the government has responded to the unprecedented backlash against this extradition amendment bill, because what we are seeing is that the government kept ignoring the opposition and the police. Their abuse of power and violence is now going unchecked because the current system can't hold those who've broken the rules to account. We've already lost confidence in the system, and I think the only way to solve these problems...is to give true democratic elections back to the Hong Kong people. The protest now was already not about opposing the extradition amendment bill.
Quite a lot of people for the past 3 months have said that they just want Hong Kong to go back to normality. And I'm curious, what does your normal Hong Kong look like?
咁我諗對於正常香港嘅定義，每個人都唔同啦。所以咁可能喺上一代嚟講，正常香港係。
A lot of people have different definitions of what a normal Hong Kong looks like, but for me, it's a city with fewer mainland Chinese people. For the older generation, a normal Hong Kong for them was a city with fewer mainlanders, fewer traffic jams, and less crowded streets. But the normal Hong Kong now is the complete opposite. And under these protests, I feel like I saw a glimpse of what the past, because there are fewer mainlanders on the streets.
好難定義，但係我比較想要冇大陸人嘅香港。
我會覺得佢哋口中所講正常嘅香港，純粹係以後每個禮拜六日啊，都唔會再有人上街示威啊。
Mine's different. I think those who wanted Hong Kong to go back to normal said that because they don't want any more protests in the street during the weekends. To be honest, part of me is getting tired of protesting every weekend, and I think we deserve to say this more than anyone. But now trust between civilians and police are gone. Even without any protests next week, the relationship between civilians and police at least will not go back to normal.I used to feel normal when I see police presence in the streets, but now I feel nervous at the sight of a police car. Without taking care of these problems, I don't think Hong Kong will go back to normality at all.
The French, for instance, love the cock.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Kei te whakarongo koe, ki te wire, marunga irirangi poho. You are listening to The Wire on 95BFM, and that was International Desk talking about the current situation in Hong Kong. Remember, you can listen back to these stories in full on 95BFM.com/bcast. We are going to a quick break right now. You are on The Thursday Wire with Justin.
In the market for a cleaner, healthier home? Craft Homes is your first choice. They work with you from design to project completion for a home that's minimum impact, maximum efficiency. Building Homestar 6 homes through to Passive House standard, Craft Homes are smarter, more energy efficient, and built from sustainable and environmentally friendly products. Don't just build a home, build a more sustainable future. Craft Homes. Homestar approved practitioners. Go to crafthomes.co.nz.
Iconic High Street boutique Storm is moving to a new location, and they're having a relocation sale to celebrate.
There's only a few days left to head into Storm's High Street store and grab samples, seconds, end of line and end of season stock, all at discount prices.
Don't miss this chance to land unique designer garments at a sale price. Don't wait, get in while stocks last. The Storm relocation sale, 23 High Street,
on now to September 15th.
Interested in 3D modelling, web design, programming, animation or robotics?
Then the Mind Labs Tech Toolbox evening courses are just what you're looking for. 5 courses to choose from. No experience necessary. Book now at motat.org.nz.
This week at the Hollywood Avondale.
Thursday at 8pm, Convoy. Chris Christopherson in modern day trucking western by the legendary Sam Peckinpah. Sunday at 2pm, Change of Habit. Elvis Presley's last film role as a hip young doctor alongside Mary Tyler Moore, who is secretly a nun.
The other night when I put my arms around you, it was no accident. It was intentional.
Then at 5pm, it's David Lynch's beautifully weird sci-fi epic, Dune. See the original before the remake.
There's no sign of the carry-all. I think they've got our carry-all.
And on Thursday, September 12th, it's David Cronenberg's excellent remake of The Fly. Plus, everything is on 35mm. Come early. Every screening has pre-show oddities, plus vegan treats and mulled wine.
The Hollywood Avondale, your local independent church of cinema.
Have at you, Trixie Wirtlewind! Yield!
Ruska, you devil by the cleansing light of Sarah, I summon...
Hey, Terry, wait, stop. We agreed that Sarah was the guiding deity of my clan?
Screw you, dickweed. You guys are OPS. We need Sarah.
Well, let's just all have bloody Sarah then. How about that? I'm cutting the baby in half.
With a little something for everyone, Sarah is the guiding light on your Saturday afternoon. The Saturday 2 to 4 with Sarah, only on 95BFM.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
Now, moving forward two time zones and a little bit closer to home, it's time for our Australian correspondent in Adelaide, Zoe. This week, the federal government in Canberra has announced a welfare reform and forcing welfare recipients to undergo drug testing for them to receive payments. And more than 500 protesters have protested in front of the state parliament in Melbourne against a new highway. Here's Zoe.
Firstly, the government are sort of trying to reinstate this whole idea of drug testing welfare recipients. So there's obviously been lots of criticism over this and the plans to drug test people on, we call it New Start or Youth Allowance. It's been totally slammed. Scott Morrison, who tried to revive this kind of very controversial legislation, and that would force about 5,000 people to undergo drug testing to be able to receive their payments. It's just obvious that it's not going to work. There will be a trial put in place in some places in Queensland, New South Wales and Western Australia. So the drug testing, it will sort of look like this. If you're on if you're a welfare recipient, you will be you'll be selected for random drug testing. So it's not like you need to do a test often or frequently. It's decided it will be random. And if the people who fail these drug tests, they'll have 80% of their welfare benefits quarantined for 2 years. And they'll have to use this cashless debit card. So this is a card that people, welfare recipients, can have, and they can only go to, I think it's like, you know, they could only really go to a supermarket or places that the card allows you to use, which is obviously totally terrifying and so controlling of our government to control how people use their pay. The cardless debit card had trialled before as well a few years ago, again, a total failure. And, you know, other examples and experts saying, like, the whole idea of drug testing, you know, these are people's lives and people need to eat and get food, and I just personally don't understand how, if someone was using drugs, why they don't deserve to eat and live and survive. And that's sort of been the national rhetoric around at this point. Again, unfortunately, the whole idea of this drug testing for welfare recipients really enhances the stigma that people who are receiving welfare payments are, you know, bludgers, or they are doing drugs or whatever, this, that, the other. And it just enhances this stigma, and something that the government's always sort of placed on people on welfare payments. But we obviously know that that's not true.
Right. And when you say reviving drug testing, has this been part of Liberal governments before?
It's sort of just been, when I say reviving, I just mean that welfare reform has been on the cards for the Liberals for a very long time. And things like the cashless debit card, and, for example, they haven't raised the rate of New Start, which is if you're over 25, I believe, and you're not at uni, you get New Start. They haven't raised the rate for New Start in 25 years. So when I say revived, I just mean continuing to not do anything, or continuing to make these very controversial legislations that could be very damaging in the long run.
But was welfare reform part of Scott Morrison's campaign during the election?
I think so. God, he just said so much during the election. I'm so sorry. I like to zone out during times when he's talking. But I do believe that. I believe that it was heavy on his books during the election.
Moving on from welfare reform, there's something happening in the state of Victoria as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, certainly. So I think I may have spoken about this a while ago, but I'll just do a little background. So the Victorian government are planning to destroy these sacred trees in Victoria in order to get rid of the trees and then just put a highway where these trees are. And this highway would take literally only 2 minutes off of the journey that the old highway already provides. So the Jabwaran people are the owners of this land, and these trees are, I think some are up to 600 years old, and there's like 200 to 300 trees that are sacred to them and to the land. And essentially, it's just an act of eco-genocide, and it's terrifying. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago, thousands of people were on the Victorian Parliament steps to rally behind this. And then yesterday afternoon, we had a bit of an update. And that is that workers and the Victorian government have actually rocked up to the site yesterday afternoon to sort of begin works. So apparently that they're removing branches, but the Jabwaran people have really put a call out and said, you know, get down here now if you can, move now or never. So this was yesterday afternoon. They sort of began work. They had, the government people there. They had police, private security protecting these people that would be removing the trees. So I don't have heaps of an update of that, just that they've started working. But there is still such a massive fight and pushback from the Jabwaran people and the people supporting them. So maybe next week I'll have an update on the situation. But if you wanted to learn more, you can go to the Jabwaran Heritage Protection Embassy page, who are sort of updating the Facebook page quite regularly with what's happening.
Yeah, but why did the Victorian government authorise cutting through the Jabwaran people's land in the first place?
Because Australia doesn't exist. These the government has invaded Australia, and they don't, it just seems like they don't care. You know, these trees are hundreds and hundreds of years old, really significant and sacred to so many people, and they just don't care. The government don't care. They want to build a highway that will have really no significance whatsoever. Why? You know, it baffles me, and it breaks so many people's hearts. And I wish I could say why. It's just because they want to put a highway there that's going to take 2 minutes off of a trip that, you know, 2 minutes or 800-year-old trees. The government chose 2 minutes, which is kind of unreal.
That was Neighbourhood Watch Ripper.
And that was our Australian correspondent Zoe talking about a recent federal welfare reform and a protest against a highway on Aboriginal land.
That was The Wire.
Kōrā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki. And that was The Wire for the 12th of September. Thank you all for tuning in. On the show today, we had Andrew Little, Chris Hipkins, and our Australian correspondent Zoe. And many thanks to Jason and Tiffany for talking to me on International Desk. Plus, special thanks to Sherry Jang and Tu Fenuaroa Natanahira for providing the English voiceover. And last but not least, my producer, Deb. And remember, we've got the full show and all our interviews today will be up on our website at 95bfm.com. Up next, it's the 1 to 4 with Sigrid. Ka hoki mai mātou e te rā wiki. We'll be back next week. Stuart will probably be at the helm. You tuned into 95BFM and I'll see you next time. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.